Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Alicia Garcia Herrero.
And today we will explore further where we stand with China-Russia relations and what it means for Europe. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter, Zhongguo Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. Joining our conversation today is Alexander Gabuev, who is Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Alex's research is focused on Russia's policy towards East and Southeast Asia, political and ideological trends in China, and China's relations with its neighbors, especially those in Central Asia. Hi, Alexander. Thanks for connecting with The Sound of Economics.
Happy to be with you, Giuseppe and Alicia. Thanks for inviting me.
In a previous episode of The Sound of Economics, recorded on the 3rd of March 2022, we have been exploring the background of Russia-China relations and the initial stance of China after the attack of Russia to Ukraine. Our listeners can find this companion episode in the show notes. Since then, China has not officially abandoned its stated support to Russia, less so when requested by the EU, or even more recently by the US-Japan during the visit of Joe Biden. China, however, seems to be abiding to the sanctions. Alex, what do you think is the real situation looking at the Russian economy? How is the Russian economy being impacted by this?
I think that when we are talking about sanctions, we are only in the beginning of assessing the impact for the economy. Right now, the Russian economy strikes as absorbing the first shocks. If you talk to your friends and family in Moscow, in some other large cities, life seems to be normal. Like all of the restaurants are packed, traffic is there. So spring and summer are in full swing. The real problem will start to bite towards the end of the third quarter, and particularly towards the end of the year. The projected dive in GDP is about 12 to 15%, and that it's hard to tell. It depends on many metrics, including what will happen in the energy market towards the fall, whether we were going to see a more conflicting reality in the market with Russia potentially shutting off some gas or oil supply towards Europe. It's up in the air, but I think that this is a very likely scenario, and that will be translated into falling incomes of the Russian budget. Definitely, the situation in the labor market is pretty pressing. Right now, the unemployment remains more or less the same as it was before the war. Whether that will be the reality towards the end of this year is very hard to know. Many of Western companies that exited the Russian market have sold their businesses with the obligation that new owners will keep the jobs for 2 years. Whether that obligation will be honored in the new economic reality is very hard to tell. We see the ruble strengthening a couple of weeks back to record levels since 2014, and now weakening again following the decision of the central bank to put down the rate this week. So there are many conflicting signals, but it's pointing to the general trend that the Russian economy is in period of structural transformation, as the head of the central bank calls it, which means a recession up to 15% of GDP. Whether that will provide political incentive for changing the course on Ukraine or for challenging Mr. Putin's grip of power, I'm very skeptical about this.
And going to the relations with China, which we want to focus on today, can we say something more about the current situation? You're saying that there is a restructuring announced of the economy, which basically underpins a recession in reality. To what extent Russia is really relying on China? That's a question that a lot of us are asking ourselves. Russia seems to be using its own international payment system, for example, and there are no really signs of extensive use of the Chinese digital currency. So are we heading to further financial fragmentation, or do you expect Russia to finally need to rely on China's financial architecture and consequently on China's economy more heavily?
So there is a current situation, and we should distinguish between the financial architecture or reliance on the payment systems and RMB and the reliance on trade with China and then investment and technology. So there are four different baskets. The current situation and the situation towards the end of this year and then going forward, I think, are different. Before the war in the 2021, which was kind of the last normal year where we have sort of good statistics, Russia was in the recovery stage after the COVID crisis. China was roughly 18% of Russia's external trade. The structure is very similar to Russia's trade with the European Union. It's mostly commodities as Russian exports and some industrial products, machinery, tools, and ready-made goods imported from China. Since March, Russia stopped publishing its customs statistics. So it is harder to assess what kind of share China's trade is with Russia. We see that trade is stable and growing, and there are two reasons for that. Russia's imports from China are decreasing, but not as rapidly as Russia's imports from the European Union. Imports from the European Union in March and April, according to Eurostat data, have collapsed by roughly 60% compared to the same period in 2021. In China, there is a decrease, but it's not as dramatic as decrease in trade with Europe. And then on exports to China, it's growing because of the increased oil and commodity prices. So here we have a mixed picture, but I think that the prediction is that towards the end of the year, reliance on China in terms of being a major trading partner will only increase. And then going forward, China will be like demand in China and then supply from China will be one of the major external factors in the Russian economy, because obviously imports from Europe will go down significantly, and then exports to Europe will go down as a result of the sanctions and Europe's attempts to diversify away from Russian oil and gas. So that's on trade, and it's, I think, pretty important. On investment, we don't see any new investments from China coming to Russia, and that's very predictable. Sanctions landscape is very dynamic, and it's moving into negative territory. So more and more sanctions being slapped on Russia. Capital controls are back. There is recession in the Russian economy. Aggregated demand will go down. So it's not really the best time to invest. We know that some global companies who are exiting the Russian market, particularly energy companies like BP, Exxon, and Shell, are talking to Chinese state-owned companies in order to sell them stakes in projects that they have in Russia. I think that so far, Chinese companies are very reluctant to purchase those shares because it's unclear whether sanctions will be applied to these projects in the future or not. And the U.S. Treasury is maintaining as much ambiguity as it can. And it's also unclear why you would purchase anything in Russia, where instead of investment, you can have an offtake contract where you can write the terms. So I think that on investment, Russia will not see that much of Chinese money coming into the country now with this very unpredictable situation and probably going forward. The assets in Russia will be cheap, but they will be not necessarily worth investing. It's much easier to sell goods and then take offtake contracts buying Russian commodities. On technology, we see that China is not supplying Russia with tech that Russia needs in the wake of sanctions. And it's also predictable because the sanctions themselves are pretty biting. Relations with the US and Europe are very important for China. So it doesn't violate the primary sanctions. But it's not an unfamiliar reality. We've seen that movie before following 2014. Or introduction of CATSA by the U.S. Congress in 2017, China was all the time compliant and sometimes over-compliant with regard to sanctions because so much of economic activity can be really conducted within the scope of permissible. And then final point on financial infrastructure, yes, I think that we see a lot of caution on Chinese Union Pay and then Chinese banks working in Russia, because a lot of their counterparts are sanctioned now. And again, the sanction landscape is worsening for Russia. My problem here is that Russia doesn't have any other real strategy, as if not rely more on settlement in RMB. Russia and China were working hard on pushing this settlement in bilateral currencies, like in national currencies, and moving away from US dollars and euros. That was tough because RMB is still not fully convertible. A lot of Russian companies wanted to have part of their contracts in RMB, but then bulk of their contracts in euros in order to be able to repatriate money back to Russia. Right now, access to euro and USD liquidity is getting increasingly complicated because of sanctions. Your imports from Eurozone is going down to zero. And then your imports from China is also growing as a result, because Chinese goods are substituting some of the European goods. So in theory, it makes more sense to move a lot of settlement into RMB, where Russian commodity exporters will sell their commodities to China, get RMB, spend this RMB on buying goods in China and being paid by Russian importers in ruble back at home. So I would expect that this will be the major trend line going forward. So a lot of trade will move to RMB. And that's how China turns RMB into de facto reserve currency for Russia, even without making it convertible.
Alicia, do you want to comment on this overview that Alex just gave to us, seen also from your observatory, since you're sitting in Taipei?
Well, I quite agree on the fact that China doesn't seem, that's all we know, to be very helpful economically. Narrative-wise, it is being helpful. We can move on to that one in the next question. But deeds-wise, facts-wise, China's been extremely careful, even with things that Russia really needs, such as drones, you know, anything that is dual fusion, military, civil, or commercial technology. I don't see any signs of China. There may be ways to bypass, but I think they're trying very hard to stay out of the limelight when people are watching. And to me, it's just fascinating how, without such help, the Russian economy is still doing pretty well. I mean, maybe we would disagree as to how well, because first of all, I'm not an expert, but it's seemingly well. Although I am sure that there's a lot of inflated, you know, kind of exchange rate wise. I mean, the so strong exchange rate doesn't make any sense. But beyond that, I think the reality is the long term. China needs to be there in the long term. And Russia needs to be there for China in the long term. So that's the only point I want to add, and I'm finished here, that also China is becoming isolated in a different way. This is COVID. This is, you know, a lot of, if you look at Japan, for example, I mean, the stance of Japan on China has changed dramatically. South Korea, same thing. And this was before Biden's trip, let's face it. I mean, it's like Ukraine was a kind of wake-up call. I don't think Japan reacted in the way it has because of Ukraine only, but because of Taiwan, because of its own backyard, if I may say so. So because of that, I think China is becoming isolated and it needs strategic partnerships. And so in a way, the idea that why would China help Russia? And, well, first, it's not helping as much because it fears the sanctions. Second, it does need to help because the last thing China wants is to become isolated, and then we will move on this question. So China, Russia, plus what? Because even that, you know, it may look big, but frankly speaking, if the rest of the world is somewhere else, it isn't as big. So I guess it's all about how this tandem can, in a way, bring others on board. And I think that's the key issue that China is pushing, not Russia so much in my view, but rather China for Russia and for both. So that's a big help in my view.
Well, following up on what you're saying, Alicia, so the question of the BRICS somehow comes to my mind, because you're speaking about a China that needs to create further alliances, that needs to avoid to be completely isolated in an international landscape, which is trying to constrain more and more. Alex, What do you think about this potential comeback of BRICS as a narrative or an extension of the BRICS? You know, we've been seeing also on the narrative side that there is an attempt, besides the ones that explicitly have been aligning with the United States, Europe, Japan, and you name it, Australia, you know, these Indo-Pacific configurations, which are getting strengthened and strengthened in that area. What do you see about these potential others that could join China and Russia in such an alliance or whatever kind? I mean, I don't even think alliance is the right term to be used for that, but area of interest or whatever we want to call it.
First, I would slightly disagree with Alicia. I would say that, yes, China is becoming more isolated because of COVID and bottlenecks and all of the complications brought to logistics and ability to conduct business in China because of the COVID policies and COVID restrictions. But at the same time, diversifying away from China is much easier said than done. And like we have multiple studies that moving your supply chain out of China is very expensive and tricky. And yes, people are more serious about this because of COVID and because of the balkanization of the global trade system, the tariffs, the trade war between China and the US. And if we're going to have a new administration in the US in 2024, this tariff war might be accelerated. But still, a lot of studies point to the fact that many businesses still keep their production in China and definitely cannot abandon the Chinese market. Like the most recent one I saw, which was a good one, was in Marco Polo by Margarita Rudnick, where she went through some case studies and established that companies that declared that they're moving out of China are in fact not doing this because of multiple complications. And then second point is that China is also active in being part of various regional initiatives on promoting free trade. China is part of RCEP, and yes, everybody says that it's not super deep or comprehensive, but still, China is a part of a free trade agreement in the Asia Pacific that has some new rules in it. And China also has officially applied to CPTPP. This is something very tangible and something real. Whether China will ever be part of the agreement, whether it meets its criteria, is another matter. But definitely, China wants to be involved in various forms of regional economic cooperation, being at the table when the norms are written and being active in its trade policy. Unlike the US, like the framework that was announced during the Quad meeting is neither deep nor comprehensive and not really having a lot of meat on the bones. At the same time, I think China is interested in pushing some of the alternative formats. And its concern is very clear with the geopolitical tensions brought by Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the movement to cancel Russia from multiple organizations, including the UN, which is increasingly dysfunctional when one of the members, permanent members of the Security Council, is now being canceled. The same moves in G20 that might paralyze this organization. We might end up with many formats of global governance being paralyzed. And then China, still at the table in the UN and in G20, wants to work around some additional arrangements which would put China at the core. I don't think it's alternative arrangements, but China wants to create this institutional backup that will allow it to work with other major players. BRICS definitely comes to mind as one of the cornerstones of this alternative arrangements. BRICS is very shallow. These countries don't trade much except with China. These countries don't invest much. They don't do much together. So there are endless MOUs and endless agreements that are mostly existing on paper. But at the same time, you see the deliberate effort of China to make this organization more present, more alive than it was before, and probably expanding to create an alternative club that it's not so much dominated by the United States and its allies. It's work in progress. I don't think that China has a very clear goal in mind that this is going to be an alternative to G7 or G20. But definitely China wants to create as many options as possible for itself and to be in the lead of these institutions.
Alex, continuing on this global stance of China and this pair with Russia, how does Russia understand President Xi's global security initiative?
I think that Russia has other much bigger fishes to fry now in Donbass. And everything what Russia does now revolves around the war and sanctions and its relationship with the West. So ties to other players are important, but they are much more about Russia than about global governance. I think that Xi's initiative borrows a lot of pages and talking points from the Russian views on this, including indivisibility of security, that nobody can strengthen their security at the expense of the other. So Russia is very likely to endorse this view officially and say, oh, it's actually in line with traditional Moscow views. We were the first to push this through. And it's very good that our friend Xi Jinping is now adopting a very similar stance. And China is basically on board with the principles of the global security architecture.
Alicia, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, the only difference is that I'm looking at it from China's perspective. I think what China is doing with this is to offer its like-minded partners economics plus security, because until months ago, the only thing we could imagine for China on the security side would have been the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. But I feel it's not, an organization that is comparable by all means and purposes to NATO. And the question is, does China want to create a new NATO type? Of course, not NATO, but or is it going to be looser? My sense is that, as everything else for China, like BRI, Belt and Road Initiative, or any other initiative, China likes hub and spoke. So China likes, China-centric institutions. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization isn't designed that way. So I think in the global security initiative, China will play a much more central role. And I don't know how Russia might take this, but the reality is that, as Alex said it very clearly, it has other fishes to fry. So, it's a good time. Because even if maybe China is not perceived as, military power, it's a good time to showcase itself as such, because nobody else in this ecosystem, in this block, can challenge that very clearly at this current juncture. So I think it's a very timely offer. And this idea of the global security alliance is going to grow. In fact, we are hearing that this has been discussed in several countries in Latin America, including with opposition leaders. Guess whom? Of course, Lula in Brazil. So, it's starting to cave in somehow, but it's much more hub and spoke, China-centric than Russia may have liked. But the reality is that that's where we are now, given the situation in Ukraine and Russia's situation as such, as Alex was describing.
But there is another element in this equation, which, of course, has been mentioned a couple of times, but we only tangentially spoken about, which is, of course, the United States. And my question, going also towards the end of this conversation, is that the recent aggressive stance from the USA during Biden's trip to Asia and Anthony Blinken's speech on China on 26th of May does not seem to appease a situation which is already very complicated. What is your view on the United States narrative building on this context?
Well, I think that there is continuity with regard to China policy in the US. There are some tactical disagreements, but definitely China is the major priority for the 21st century. And like when we talk about great power competition, it's primarily about the US and China. And that's a much more comprehensive challenge for the US. China is more formidable power and a more formidable competitor than Soviet Union has ever been. And then this competition is across multiple domains. It's about military, it's about technology, it's about the standards, it's about economics, it's about many more things. It's no surprise that the CIA, with its new director, Bill Burns, who's a former boss at Carnegie Endowment, has created a China mission center, but not a Russia mission center, despite importance of Russia as a new source of challenges. So here, this focus on China is very predictable. The administration wants to be better organized than Trump's White House. And at the same time, we don't see too many new initiatives coming out beyond strengthening Quad and like doing much more with allies and reinvigorating this notion that alliances are there and that what sets the U.S. apart from lonelier powers like China and Russia. And this attempt to strengthen the base of the U.S. industry at home, to work on the infrastructure bill, to invest more in research and stay one step ahead of China, doing more on semiconductors and chips at home in order to diminish dependence on China and deny China some of the advantages that it has enjoyed. When it comes to Taiwan and the recent statement of Biden, we see that the president can be sometimes undisciplined in the way he expresses himself. And that there are attempts of the White House to walk back some of his statements. So I wouldn't pay too much attention or to say that there is the change of U.S. strategy. President himself was one day after he made this remark on the record that no U.S. policy towards Taiwan has not changed. So there is a lot of ambiguity there. But obviously, focus on China will stay regardless of the need to work now much more with allies on Russia and the second order, third order effects of Russia's war on Ukraine.
And Alicia, because we are going to unfortunately have to close the episode soon, what else we might have to reflect upon on this, which we didn't yet touched, or any other final comments from your side as well, or questions to Alex?
Well, I would end by saying that, of course, when seeing from Europe, the war in Ukraine, and rightly so, because it's such a dramatic event, is kind of the center. And then, you know, China is kind of out there, whether it supports or not, but it's kind of Ukraine-centric or Russia-centric. But from this part of the world, we see it differently. We see China, I would say behind, because I don't want to mean that China was behind, literally, I mean, not with double intention, behind, and in a way overshadowing, yeah, because there's another conflict here in the Pacific, and that's a humongously important one for the global economy. We've already seen what may happen when you have the largest or second largest, I guess, depending on oil or gas, energy producer in the world. But what about semiconductors? What about China with one third of intermediate goods exported globally? I mean, what about that shock? So I think I agree with Alex that that's possibly too big to even, you know, swallow. But I want to say that, and this is Blinken's message, yes, maybe the policy may not have changed. Maybe, you know, Biden is a little bit elderly and he keeps on making the same mistake three times already. Sorry, I think increasingly it's not going to be a mistake. Because when you make it three times, you mean it. And this strategic ambiguity on Taiwan was already conflicting with the U.S. policies already on Taiwan. I mean, actually, full-fledged agreements, yeah, on the Taiwan Act and beyond. So I think things are changing. And that's going to make this part of the world that has been resilient and cozy for so long, bringing growth to the global economy, increasingly complex. So yes, we focus on Ukraine and Russia, and rightly so. But I'm saying let's not put the focus away from this massive risk for the global economy. And also the fact that there is this link that is by now, and I mean, we can't deny it anymore, yeah? The link between Russia and China, for whatever it's worth, it could be narrative, it could be words and not deeds, but it could be both. And certainly it's reshaping our understanding of the global economy. So I think that's what I want our listeners to get away from my side, from this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Alicia and Alex. Some last remarks from your side as well.
Well, I think that this war should be viewed as a 9/11 type of event that will have profound changes. And it's not only the war that's impactful. There are multiple trends that are aligning, which is US-China competition, the global climate crisis, the long-term effects from the previous global economic credit crunch in 2008-2009. But now this war will make every single dimension of this worse, particularly through the inflation risk that it creates, the food crisis that is likely to result from this war, higher energy prices, and fissures that will be exacerbated in the Western societies, as well as multiple crises in the developing world. So this is all not looking good. Many global institutions are crumbling. And I think that we all should be alerted just beyond the immediate effect of this war on the situation of, in Europe, like both economic and security, and on dynamics in the Asia-Pacific, Russia-China rapprochement, about the larger picture and the second order, third effects that will play out in the coming decade.
Thank you, Alex. And obviously, you are not depicting a very rosy picture, to say it mildly. But nevertheless, we are trying our best at the Sound of Economics to keep this conversation on. And we could, of course, discuss for much longer. But unfortunately, that's all the time we have at the moment. But we are going to keep discussing on this and monitoring both at the Sound of Economics as well as at Bruegel with our blogs, publications, and so on. So I would like to thank you for joining us today. And this brings us to the end of this episode, which was part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes as well our monthly newsletter, Zhongguan Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. As usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Alexander, Alicia, thanks a lot for joining this conversation. And thanks to our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye, thank you. Thank you, Alex. You.